Chapter 9. Legend has it that the asteroid was a lump of pure gold, the core of which remained intact and now lies buried deep beneath the castle. Whatever the actual composition was, it certainly had an above-average density. When it hit Lothian's southern continent, a couple of centuries before humans arrived, it carved out a perfectly circular crater 3 kilometers across. The rim wall was over 100 meters high, with quite a steep inner face. The central peak rose to nearly 400 meters. The first settlers, all from Scotland, had a large Edinburgh contingent among them, nostalgic for the old town and dynamic in their approach to their new home world. Their bigger and better attitude was given an aggressive outlet when it came to building the new capital, Leithpool, with the crater as its nucleus. An entire river, the High Forth, was diverted for 11 kilometers along a newly built aqueduct embankment to pour over the crater's rim wall, slowly filling the ring-shaped lake inside. They wanted a castle at the center, of course, but the new island's easy gradient hardly matched the jutting rock crag to be found dominating the heart of old Edinburgh. A fleet of civil engineering bots got to work, carving as the surrounding waters rose. Over the following years, 3 rock blade pinnacles were hacked out from the solitary mound, sharp and rugged enough to fit into any alpine range. A Bavarian-style castle was grafted onto the apex of the tallest peak, reached by a solitary road that spiraled up around the sheer rock cliffs. Beneath the castle, and occupying the rest of the harsh mount, monolithic granite buildings sprang up, separated by broad cobbled roads and twisting alleyways. There were no parks and no trees, for there was no soil where living things could grow, only the naked rock exposed by the cutting tools of the bots. As the construction work progressed, the entire overfinanced mechanism of government moved in, from the doughty parliament building itself to the elaborate palace of the Supreme Court, bloated office hive ministries, to the Romanesque planetary bank. With the world's rulers came the usual circus of subsidiaries, the expensive restaurants, hotels, clubs, the office service companies, theatres, corporate headquarters, concert halls, lobbying firms, legal partnerships, and media companies. Swarming through the somber official buildings were the army of elected representatives, their aides, researchers, interns, spouses, civil servants, and pimps. Only the top echelon actually lived on the castle mount. Everyone else commuted from the city that grew up on the other side of the rim. Suburbs and boroughs sprawled for kilometre after kilometre down the incline of the crater's outer walls, home to 4.5 million people. Leithpool was one of Adam Elvin's favourite cities. Its layout was a welcome exception to the neat grids found on most worlds. Here the streets wound down the outside of the rim in random curves, intersecting and branching chaotically. Light industry and housing all had their separate zones, but they were squashed together in true jigsaw layout with admirable disregard for logic. Broad terrace parks formed pretty green swaths through the stone and composite structures. A good underground metro network and street-level trams kept the private traffic to a minimum. Elevated rail lines knitted together the main boroughs, meandering their way down to the bottom of the northeastern slope, where the CST station squatted on the outskirts. Today, Adam was walking along the western quadrant of Prince's Circle, the road that ran around the top of the crater rim. It was the main retail district, renowned on many planets. A rampart of tall department stores and brand flagship shops formed the outer side of the broad road, while the inner side curved down sharply to the quiet waters of the Ring Lake, 20 meters below the pavement. When the city was built, the rim had been leveled off, with the exception of the High Forth Inlet, which was roofed by a twin arch bridge, and the similar outlet gully on the opposite side that sent the water foaming down a long artificial cascade through the most exclusive residential districts. He spent a quiet 20 minutes walking among the crowds that boiled along the shop fronts. Every building sported a white and scarlet Celtic Crown national flag. Without exception, they were at half-mast. 2 days earlier, Lothian's team had been knocked out of the cup. That had knocked the new Scottish nation hard. It was as if the planet had gone into mourning. Eventually he found the cafe he was looking for, a door at the side of a big electrical retailer, opening onto stairs that took him up to the first floor. The large room was some kind of converted gallery, with high ceilings and huge curving windows that looked down on Prince's Circle. He found a slightly tatty sofa in front of one window, and ordered a hot chocolate with two choc, chip, and hazelnut shortcakes from the teenage waitress. The view he had out toward Castlemount was peerless. A few hundred meters to the south, one of the monorail tracks stretched out across the calm, dark water. A single silver carriage streaked along it, shuttling late office workers over to their desks. "Impressive, isn't it?" a voice said at his shoulder. Adam glanced up to see Bradley Johansson standing behind him, holding a large mug of tea. As always, the tall man gave the impression of being slightly disconnected from the world around him. There was something about his thin, elegant face that made him appear far more aristocratic than any grand family member. "I enjoy it," Adam said evenly. "Of course it looks even better at Mardi Gras," Bradley said, sitting down on the sofa beside Adam. "They light up the castle with huge hologram projectors for the whole week, and during the closing ceremony they let off real fireworks overhead. If you ever give me the time off, I'll come and take a look."
"That's what I wanted to see you about."
Bradley stopped as the waitress brought Adam's hot chocolate and smiled winningly at her. She sneaked a smile back at him before hurrying off to the next table. Adam tried not to show his annoyance at the little silent exchange. It was just one more reminder of his own age. "You're going to give me more free time?" he asked.
"Quite the opposite, old chap. That's why I wanted to see you in person, to impress upon you how important the next few years are going to be. After all, you're not a lifelong guardian. Your commitment to the cause has always been more financially oriented. I want to know if you're prepared to continue your role when things get a lot tougher."
"Tougher? That my old bitch almost caught me on Verlaine's."
"Oh, come on, Adam. She was never even close. You outsmarted her beautifully."
"And continue to do so. The components are all arriving on schedule." "Save the flattery for the bourgeois. I can't be motivated that way."
"Very well. So will you continue to provide us with your assistance? And if so, how much will it cost?
What exactly are you wanting from me? This is the time which the Starflyer has worked for. The time for good men to draw a line in the sand and say, no more. No further," Adam muttered. Bradley sipped his tea and smiled. "In the past, maybe. But in the here and now, I know what must be done. Little of it will be pleasant. Revolution never is for those who live through it."
"This is not revolution, Adam. This is my crusade. I am going to fling the corrupter of humanity into the depths of night beyond hell, where even the devil fears to tread. And that will be the least it deserves. I will avenge myself and all the others who have been consumed by the Starflyer's evil."
"Bravo.
You have your beliefs and convictions, Adam. I have mine. Please don't mock them. I find it unpleasant. What I am proposing is to extend our combat activities off far away. I want to directly confront the Starflyer's agents and interests in the Commonwealth. And now, would you care to tell me what your cooperation will cost, if that doesn't make you too much of a capitalist?"
"Direct confrontation? You want me to lead your troops into battle?"
"Yes. You know more about covert operations and security procedures than any of us. That makes you invaluable to me, Adam. I need you for this.
All I can say is that without a human race, there will not be any socialist society. So will you help me?" It was a fair question, Adam admitted to himself. Not one he expected in a pleasant cafe overlooking a serene lake with a fairy tale castle. But then, where should such questions be delivered? Just what do I want out of life? Once again, his resolve faltered. It had been a principle for so long not to seek rejuvenation, because it was a purchase of the bourgeois and their plutocrat masters. Society should be structured so that everyone received it, regardless of circumstances. The ancient political dream of justice and equality for all, true socialism. For all his active involvement in the cause, the disruption and violence he'd unleashed against the establishment, nothing had changed. But that doesn't make me wrong. When he thought of the others, ex-friends and comrades, who had betrayed the movement over the decades, by abandoning them, or worse, he knew what his course must be.
despite the intensely human wish to live forever. If even someone as committed as he was gave in at the end, what hope ultimately could there be? I'm tired, Bradley. Really, truly tired. I've seen my ideals crushed by the plutocrats for my whole life. I'm clinging to a lost cause, because I don't know anything else. Do you realize how pathetic that makes me? Well, I don't want to save the Commonwealth anymore. I've tried to do that for 50 years and got nowhere. I can't do it anymore. There's no point. Capitalism or the Starflyer, I don't care which of them finishes off this society. I'm through with it. No, you're not. Stop trying to talk up your bargaining position, Adam. You are not going to stand by and watch an alien commit genocide against your own species. You're an idealist. It's a magnificent flaw, one I quite envy. Now what can I offer you for your invaluable services? I don't know. Hope, maybe? Fair enough. Bradley nodded at the remarkable castle atop its pinnacle. Sunlight was striking the slender conical turrets, making their polished rock walls shine with a vivid bronze and emerald hue. The original castle back in Edinburgh was the seat of Scottish nationalism. It symbolized everything to the die-hard believers. Despite all the changes and defeats they endured, the castle stood solid at the center of their capital. They waited for generations for the Scottish nation to be properly reborn after their bonny prince was lost. There were times when the cause seemed impossible or even cursed. They regained their independence from the English only to lose it again right away with the formation of federal Europe. But once people reached the stars, the true nation was reborn here and on two other worlds. An ideal kept alive in the darkness can flourish if it has the chance, no matter how long the night lasts. Don't give up on your ideals, Adam. Not ever. Very trite, I'm sure. Then try this. I've seen what societies like ours progress into. I've walked on their worlds and admired them firsthand. This Commonwealth is only an interim stage for a species like ours. Even your socialism will be left behind in true evolution. We can become something wonderful, something special. We have that potential. Adam stared at him for a long time, wishing he could see through those enigmatic eyes into the mind beyond. Bradley's faith in himself and his cause had always been extraordinary. There had been times over the last 30 years when Adam really wished he could write Bradley off, in the same way the Commonwealth establishment dismissed him, as nothing more than a crackpot conspiracy theorist. But there were too many little details for him to be laughed off. His superb intelligence sources, for a start, the way little facets of Commonwealth policy were organized, seemingly out of kilter with the interests of the grand families and intersolar dynasties. Adam was so close to believing the whole Starflyer notion. At the very least, he didn't disbelieve it anymore. There's something I'd like to know, though I'm afraid it might be a personal weakness on my part. I will be honest with you, Adam. I owe you that much. Where do you go for your rejuvenation? Is there some secret underground clinic that I don't know about which provides the treatment for people like us? No, Adam, there's nowhere like that. I use the Unstorn Clinic on Jaruva. It's very good. Adam paused as his e-butler called the CST interstellar timetable up into his virtual vision. Is Jaruva a town somewhere? No, it's a planet. CST shut down the gateway 280 years ago, after a civil war between various nationalist culture factions and the radical evangelicals. The only thing they hated worse than each other was the Commonwealth. There were some unpleasant acts of terrorism committed before the isolation. Things have calmed down considerably since then, thankfully. They have rebuilt their society, with each faction having its own homeland. The structure is similar to Earth in the mid-20th century. None of the mini-nations are socialist, I'm afraid. I see, Adam said carefully. And how do you get there? There is a path which leads to Jaruva. The Sylphon don't really use it anymore. Somehow I knew you'd give me an answer like that. I will be happy to take you there and pay for a rejuvenation, if that's what you want. Let's leave that possibility open, shall we? As you wish. But the offer is sincere and remains. I wish I believed, as you do. You are not far from it, Adam. Not really. I expect what is about to happen over the next few years will convince you. But then, I expect it to convince everyone. All right, Adam said. He had a sense of near relief now he'd made his decision. Many people spoke of the contentment that came from accepting defeat. He was mildly surprised to find it was true. So what do you want the Guardians to do in the Commonwealth? And bear in mind, I won't ever repeat Abaddon Station. I don't do political statement violence anymore. My dear chap, neither do I. And thank you for agreeing to this. I know how it conflicts with your own goals. Don't give up on them. You will live to see a socially just world. Like a priest will see heaven. Bradley's soft smile was understanding and sympathetic. What are you going to hit first? Adam asked. The second chance is my primary target right now. Part of your task is going to be assembling a crew to obliterate it. Old folly. You can never destroy knowledge. Even if we were to succeed and blow the second chance to pieces, they'll build another and another and another until one is finally completed. They know how to build them, therefore they will be built. I expect you're right, unfortunately. But destroying the second chance will be a severe blow to the Starflyer. It wanted the starship built, you know. I know, I received the shotgun message. Adam stared out at Castle Mount for some time. You know, castles once had a purpose other than symbolism. They used to hold the invaders at bay and keep the kingdom safe. We don't build them anymore. We need them, though, now more than ever. What a pair we make, Adam said, the optimist and the pessimist. Which do you claim to be? I think you know. To the mild dismay of his staff, Wilson always arrived in the office at around 7:30 in the morning. With management meetings, training sessions, interviews, engineering assessments, media reports, a one-hour gym workout, and a dozen other items scheduled every day, he didn't leave until after 9 most evenings. He took lunch at his desk, rather than waste time going to the excellent canteen on the ground floor. His influence began to percolate through the whole Starship project, and with it, his enthusiasm. Procedures were tightened under his relentless directives. Policy became clear-cut and effective. Pride settled around the complex, driving the crews onward. Every week, Wilson met up with Nigel Sheldon to perform their ritual inspection tour of Second Chance. They arrived at the gateway and kicked off into the assembly platform. Both of them pointing at and gossiping about some new section of the huge ship, acting like a pair of school kids. All of the plasma rockets were installed now, along with their turbo pumps and power injectors. Big reaction mass tanks were being eased into cavities along the ship's central engineering superstructure, dark gray ellipsoids whose internal structure was a honeycomb maze of tiny sacks. It's the ultimate slosh baffle design, Wilson explained, as the two of them glided along the assembly grid above the central cylinder. The sacks can squeeze out their contents no matter what acceleration maneuver we're pulling, and while we're coasting, they hold the fluid stable. If only we'd had that on the old Ulysses, we'd have saved ourselves a lot of mechanical trouble. The materials technology has come a long way since those days. Nigel held on to one of the platform grids, pausing directly above an egg-shaped tank that was being gently eased into position by robot arms. Construction crew and remote mobile sensors were swarming around it like bees to their queen. How come we're not using hydrogen? I thought that gives the best specific impulse for rocket exhausts. When you're talking chemical reactions, sure. But the plasma rockets operate at such a high energy level. They break their working fluid down into subatomic particles. The Niling desyncs we're carrying pump so much power in, this plasma is actually hotter than a fusion generator's exhaust. With that kind of efficiency, cryogenics is a waste of time. Of course, in an ideal world, we'd be using mercury as the propellant fluid, but even that has handling problems, not to mention cost and sourcing for the kind of volume we're looking at. So what we've wound up with is a very dense hydrocarbon. It's almost pure crude oil. But the chemists have tweaked the molecular structure so it remains liquid over a huge temperature range. Given the type of near-perfect insulation we've got cloaking the tanks, the thermal support we have to provide for the fuel is minimal. Nigel gave the tank a thoughtful look.
I always used to think rockets were dead simple. The principle is as simple as you can get. It's just the engineering which is complex. But we're doing our best to reduce that. Modern techniques allow us to do away with whole layers of ancillary systems. I heard you've instigated a design review board. Final design approval, yeah. I prefer that method to the multiple steering committees you'd set up. Wilson let go of the grid and pushed off so he was drifting along the length of the starship toward the life support wheel. It gives the project an overall architecture policy. I'm not arguing. This is your show now. They passed over the wheel section. The internal decks were clearly visible now, with decking and wall paneling fixed to the stress structure, showing the internal layout. We should start fixing the hull in place by the end of next month, Wilson said. Not too much slippage, then. No. You gave me a good team. And the unlimited funding helps. Actually, it's not unlimited, and I've noticed it's still rising. That was inevitable, but it really should have plateaued now we're entering the final design freeze. We've already started to make a few modifications to the central cylinder to accommodate the expanded standoff observation period of the mission. The upgraded sensor suite is finishing its alpha analysis stage. It should be out to tender soon. And we already have the engineering mock-ups of the Class 3 and 4 remote probe satellites. They're being assembled for us at High Angel by Bayfoss. We're up to capacity here, and they are the experts. Most of your exploratory division geosurvey satellites are built by them. Sure. Nigel took another look at the crew accommodation decks, where an atmospheric processor had been secured in place, still wrapped in its silver packaging. Man, I still can't get over how big this beauty is. You'd think, I don't know, we could build something neater by now. A one-man starship? Wilson asked in amusement. He waved a hand at the front of the cylinder. You helped design the hyperdrive engine. I've owned smaller houses than that monster. Yeah, I know. I ought to go back and take another look at the basic equations. You do that, but I'm telling you, a car-sized starship will never catch on. I want something big and powerful around me when I go exploring the unknown. Man, oh man, Freud would have had a field day with you. Now, how's it going with the crew selection? Whew, boy, Wilson grimaced at the memory. The actual crew squad has been finalized. We've got 220 who'll start their second phase training next week. We'll select the final 50 a month before launch. The science team is a little tougher. We've passed 70 so far, and Oscar's office is trying to sort out the rest of the applications. It's the interviews that are taking up so much time. The Commonwealth has an awful lot of highly qualified people out there, and we need to put them all through assessment and psych profiling. What I'd like is a pool of about 300 to choose from. Ah. Nigel stopped himself above the rim of the life support wheel, watching a construction bot fixing a decking plate into place. Have you considered taking Dr. Bose with you? Bose? Oh, the astronomer who saw the envelopment. I think I remember Oscar mentioning he'd applied. He certainly got a lot of sponsors. Do you want me to check out if he got through the assessment? Not as such, no. The thing is, my office is getting a lot of inquiries about him. As is the vice president. For a moment, Wilson thought he meant the vice president of CST. You mean Elaine Doy? Yes, it's a bit awkward. Every time the media want to comment on the envelopment, they turn to Bose, which is understandable. The trouble is, he cooperates with them. All of them. When the guy sleeps, I've no idea. But anyway, in the public eye, he's most strongly associated with the project. It's a position he's exploited superbly. Wait a minute here. Are you telling me I've got to take him? All I'm saying is that if you were planning on taking an astronomer, you could do worse. For an obscure professor from a back of beyond planet, he's certainly a goddamn expert self-publicist. I'll tell Oscar to review the file, if that's what's bugging you. That's good. And I hope there won't be any ageism in the selection process. What? It's just that the professor is kind of closer to his time for rejuvenation than you or I. Or anyone else you're considering. That's all.
That's all. Oh, Jesus wept. The plantation where Tara Jennifer Shahif lived was on the far side of the mountains that rose up out of the northern districts of Dark Lake City. Even with a modern highway leading through them, it took the car carrying Paula and Detective Hosha Finn a good 3 hours to drive there. They turned off the junction at the start of a wide valley, the car snaking along a winding local road. The slopes on either side were heavily cultivated with coffee bushes. Every row seemed to have an agriculture bot of some kind trundling along, tending the verdant plants. Humans and buildings were less prominent within this landscape. Eventually, the car turned into the plantation through a wide gated entrance with a white stone arch. Cherry trees lined the long driveway, leading up to a low white house with a bright red clay tile roof.
All very traditional, Paula commented.
Hosha glanced out at the arch. You'll find that a lot on this world. We do tend to idolize the past. Most of us had settler ancestors who were successful even before they arrived, and the ethos lingers on. As a planet, we've done rather well from it.
If it works, don't try and fix it.
Yeah. He showed no sign that he'd picked up on any irony. The car halted on the gravel in front of the house's main door. Paula climbed out, looking around the large formal gardens. A lot of time and effort had gone into the big lawn with its palisade of trees. Tara Jennifer Shahif was standing in front of the double Ackhamwood doors, underneath the portico. Her husband, Matthew de Savuel, stood beside her, an arm resting protectively around her shoulders. He was older than she by a couple of decades, Paula noticed, thick dark hair turning to silver, his midriff starting to spread. The car drove off around to the stable block. Paula walked forward.
"Thank you for agreeing to see me," she said.
"That's all right," Tara said with a nervous smile.
She nodded tightly at Detective Finn.
"Hello again."
"I trust this won't be too upsetting," Matthew de Savoel said. "My wife had put her real-life ordeal behind her."
"It's all right, Matthew,"
Tara said, patting him.
"I won't deliberately make this difficult," Paula said. "It was your wife's family who wanted this investigation kept open."
Matthew de Savoel grunted in dissatisfaction and opened the front door.
"I feel we should have a lawyer present," he said as he walked them through the cool reception hall.
"That is your prerogative," Paula said neutrally. If de Savoel thought his wife was fully recovered, he was fooling himself badly. Nobody with 3 lifetimes behind them was as twitchy as Tara seemed to be. In Paula's experience, anyone who had been killed, accidentally or otherwise, took at least 1 regeneration post-re-life to get over the psychological trauma. They were shown into a large lounge with a stone tile floor. A grand fireplace dominated one wall, with a real grate and logs sitting at the center of it. The walls had various hunting trophies hanging up, along with the stuffed heads of alien animals, their teeth and claws prominently displayed to portray them as savage monsters.
"Yours?" Hosha asked.
"I bagged every one of them," Matthew de Savoel said proudly. "There's a lot of hostile wildlife still living up in the hills."
"I've never seen a goral that big before," Hosha said, standing underneath one of the heads.
"I wasn't aware Oaktir had a guns and hunting culture," Paula said.
"They don't in the cities," de Savoel said. "They think those of us who tend the land are barbaric savages who do it purely for sport. None of them live out here. None of them realize what sort of danger the Gorals and Vaidis pose if they get down to the human communities. There are several political campaigns to ban landowners from shooting outside cultivated lands, as if the Gorals will respect that. It's exactly the kind of oppressive crap I came here to get away from. So guns are quite easy to get hold of on this planet."
"Not a bit of it," Tara said.
She made a big show of flopping into one of the broad couches. "You wouldn't believe how difficult it is to get a license, even for a hunting rifle." Paula sat opposite her.
"Did you ever hold a license?"
"No."
Tara shook her head, smiling softly at some private joke. She took a cigarette out of her case and pressed it on the lighting pad at the bottom.
It gave off the sweet mint smell of high-quality GM Mahane.
Do you mind? It helps me relax.
Hoshafin frowned, but didn't say anything.
Did you ever possess a gun?
Paula asked. Tara laughed.
No. Or if I did, I never kept the memory. I don't think I would, though.
Guns have no place in a civilized society.
Most commendable, Paula said.
She wondered if Tara was really that unsophisticated, or if that was something she wanted to believe post-death. But then most citizens chose to overlook how easy it was to get hold of a weapon.
I'd like to talk about Wyobi Kotal.
Certainly, but like I told Detective Finn last time, I only have a couple of weeks' memory of him.
You were having an affair with him.
Tara took a deep drag, exhaling slowly.
Certainly was.
God, what a body that kid had. I don't think I'd ever forget that.
So your marriage to Morton was over?
No, not really. We were still on good terms, though it was getting a bit stale. You must know what that's like. There was an edge of mockery in her voice.
Did you have other affairs?
A couple. Like I said, I could see where it was heading with Morton. Our company was doing well. It was taking up more and more of his time. Men are like that, always obsessing about the wrong things in life.
Some men.
She extended a languid hand to de Savoel, who kissed her knuckles indulgently.
Did Morton know about the other men?
Probably, but I respected him. I didn't flaunt them. They were never the cause of any argument.
Did Morton have a gun?
Oh, don't be ridiculous. We had a good marriage.
It was coming to an end.
And we got divorced. It happens. In fact, it has to happen when you live this long.
Did he have a gun?
No.
All right. Why would you choose Tampico?
That's the place I filed the divorce from, isn't it?
Well, I don't know, I'm sure.
The first time I heard about it was right after my real life, when the insurance investigators were asking me what happened. I never even knew the place existed before.
You and Kotal bought tickets there. You left with him 4 days after your last memory dump in the Kirova Clinic's secure store.
Why did you run off with him?
I don't know. I remember meeting him. It was at a party. Then after that, it was just for the sex, really.
And he was fun, enthusiastic the way only first-lifers can be.
I enjoyed him, but I always found it hard to believe I gave up everything for him.
It was a good life Morton and I had here.
You weren't the only girl Kotal was seeing.
Really?
Somehow I'm not surprised.
He was gorgeous.
You're not jealous about that?
Irritated is about as far as it goes.
Did Wyobi have a gun?
Oh.
She appealed to her husband.
Please.
Come now, Chief Investigator, the Savoel said loftily. There's no need to take such a line.
Wyobi Kotal was also killed.
Was he?
We haven't found a body.
In fact, we haven't found your wife's body, either.
If I'd been alive, I would have turned up for rejuvenation,
Tara said sharply, and I'll thank you not to open that can of worms.
I understand.
We do have to examine every possibility,
but perhaps not out loud when it can cause such distress,
the Savoel said irately. This is not pleasant for my wife to raise such specters again, after she has finally accustomed herself to complete body loss.
That's why I'm here, Paula said, to make sure it won't happen again.
Again?
Tara's voice rose in alarm.
She stubbed her cigarette out.
You think I'll be killed again?
That's not what I meant. It would be most unusual for a killer to strike at you twice.
And you have been alive for over 20 years this time.
Please don't concern yourself about the possibility.
So? Wyobi didn't have a gun.
No,
not that I remember.
You mentioned other affairs.
Were you seeing anybody else at the same time as Kotal?
No.
Wyobi was quite enough for me.
What about enemies?
Yours or Kotal's?
I must have fallen out with many people. You do over 100 years. But I can't think of any argument or grudge that would warrant killing me. And as for Wyobi, nobody that age has enemies.
Not ones that kill.
His other girlfriend might have been angry enough.
Possibly.
Tara shuddered.
I never met her.
Do you think that's what happened?
Actually, no. If you and Wyobi were killed, then it certainly wasn't a crime of passion, or at least not a spur-of-the-moment slaying. As yet, we don't know where and when you were killed. To throw up that much uncertainty takes planning and preparation. Other than your ticket, there's no real proof you ever went to Tampico.
The divorce, the Savoel said, that was filed on Tampico. And all Tara's things were sent there.
The divorce was lodged with a legal firm, Brewer Associates, on Tampico. It was a pure data transaction. In theory, it could have been filed from anywhere inside the Unisphere. As for your effects, Tara, they were sent to a Tampico storage warehouse for 7 weeks, then removed by your authorization into a private vehicle. The insurance company investigators were unable to trace them. What I find interesting about this is your secure memory storage arrangement. There isn't one apart from the Kirova Clinic, not on Tampico, nor on any other Commonwealth planet as far as the investigators could find, though my directorate will start double-checking that now. And you would have made one. Everybody has a secure store they can update for precisely this reason. Real life. The ticket, your effects shipped out there, your divorce, it's all evidence you were settled on Tampico. But to me, the lack of a secure memory arrangement calls the whole Tampico episode into question.
But why? Tara asked. What would be the point in killing me or Wyobi? What did we do?
I don't know. The last time you were seen alive was when you had lunch with Carolyn Turner at the Low Moon Marina restaurant. If anything was wrong, you didn't tell her. In fact, she said you seemed quite normal. Carolyn was a good friend, I remember. I might even have told her about Wyobi. She says not, and certainly nothing about leaving Morton to go off with Wyobi. So if you didn't go crazy wild and run off, we have to consider you got involved in some criminal event.
I wouldn't.
Paula held up a cautionary finger, not necessarily deliberately. The logical explanation would be an accident, something you saw or discovered that you shouldn't have, and were killed because of it. My problem with that theory is where it happened. If it was here, then we only have a very small incident window to investigate. Morton had been away from home for 2 days, and was scheduled to stay at his conference for another 4 days. He says you stopped answering his calls 2 days after your lunch with Carolyn, the same day your Tampico ticket was purchased. Now, your last memory deposit in the Kirova Clinic secure store was the same day Morton went away. So, at the most, you had 4 days for this event to happen to you. I believe we can safely say it didn't happen in the 2 days prior to your lunch, which leaves us with just 2 days, 48 hours, for it to occur. Police records don't show any major crime incident that month, Hosha said. Actually, it was a quiet year. Then they were good criminals. Clever ones, Paula said. You never caught them, and the only evidence is this ice murder. That doesn't leave us with a lot to go on. I have to say that if Shahif and Kotal walked in on something bad, then the chances of discovering what actually happened are slim. Which leaves us with Tampico. You arrived and bumped straight into something you shouldn't have. Our hypothetical Tampico criminals maintained the illusion that you were alive by picking up your effects and then filing for the divorce. That would explain the lack of a memory store.
What sort of criminals?
Tara asked shakily.
What would they be doing to make them kill me and Wyobi?
It's only a theory, Paula told her quickly. I have difficulty in accepting major criminal conspiracies. The probability is extremely low, though we can't ignore it. But that implausibility does leave us with a quandary. If it wasn't that, and it wasn't your private life, which appears blameless, then what did happen? Tara fumbled with her case and lit another cigarette. You're the detective. Everybody knows that. Her hands were trembling as she took a drag. Matthew de Savoel held her tight, glaring at Paula.
Have you got enough? He snapped.
For now, she said calmly.
Find out,
Tara called out as Paula and Hosha started to leave.
Please. I have to know. Everything you've said. It wasn't a freak accident, was it?
I've told myself that for 20 years.
Told everybody I had a mad romantic impulse and ran off with Wyobi. Because if you say it and keep on saying it, then that becomes what happened. It was like making up the memory.
But I know. I really know it didn't happen like that. I'll do what I can, Paula said.
Where now? Hosha asked as the car drove away from the big isolated plantation house.
The ex-husband, Morton.
He sneaked a look at her. You got any idea what happened?
It wasn't an accident. I believe Tara. She used to be too sensible to do anything like running off with Wyobi. He was already giving her everything she wanted from the relationship. That means Tampico is all wrong. It was a setup. An alibi. Used to be sensible? You saw what she is today.
Yeah. That's what you meant by investigating people, isn't it?
Of course.
She turned to stare out of the car's windows, seeing nothing but a blur of big shaggy walrus trees that had been planted as a windbreak for the neat plantation bushes.
It's people who commit crimes. So that's where you'll find the motivation. People.
It was so instinctive, so obvious. She didn't have to think to talk to him. Her parents, or rather the couple she had thought to be her parents during her childhood, had sincerely believed that instinct could be stillbirthed. It was the old nature versus nurture argument, and in this particular ultramodern chapter of it, they desperately wanted to prove to the whole Commonwealth that nurture could be the victor, that there was no preordained fate, especially not the one Paula's creators intended for her. The planet where she was birthed was called Huxley's Haven, though the other Commonwealth worlds derisively called it the Hive. Settled in 2102, it was funded and populated by the Human Structure Foundation, a strange collective of genetic researchers and intellectual socio-political theorists. They were keen to explore the genetic possibilities for psychoneural profiling. Now they were clear of Earth's restrictions, believing it possible to create a perfectly stable society by implementing the phrase, each to his own, to a degree that the rest of humanity found quite chilling. A lot of Anglo-Saxon surnames originated from occupation. Taylor, Thatcher, Crofter. The aim of the Foundation was to make the link solid and unbreakable, determined within an individual's DNA. Professions couldn't be installed wholesale, of course. A psychoneural profile merely gave a person the aptitude to do his or her designated job, while simpler, physiological modifications complemented the trait. Doctors would be given dexterous fingers and high visual acuity, while farm workers and builders possessed a large, strong physique. So it went, right through the entire spectrum of human activity. The traits were bundled together and fixed to prevent genetic drift. As far as the traits were concerned, there would never be any mixed profiles. The Foundation scrupulously avoided using the word pure in its press releases. The Commonwealth as a whole detested the notion. Right from its conception, Huxley's Haven became a near pariah state. There were even serious calls for military police-style intervention made in the Senate, which contravened the organization's constitution. The Commonwealth was set up originally to guarantee individual planet freedom within an overall legal framework. In the end, the Foundation was able to proceed because legally the planet was independent and free. After several prominent and well-financed private court cases against the Foundation came to nothing, it was CST's turn to face a barrage of media-supported pressure to close the gateway. Nigel Sheldon had to reluctantly argue the case for keeping it open. If they closed one gateway because of a cause activist campaign, that left all gateways vulnerable to people who disagreed with the planet's culture, religion, or politics. The Hive stayed connected to the Commonwealth, though it never really contributed to the mainstream economic and financial structure. Quietly, and with considerable scientific flair, the Foundation got on with the job of building their unique society. Some people never did accept the lost court cases or the Foundation's right to pursue its goal. A greater human right took precedence, they argued. In their view, Huxley's Haven was a planet of genetically modified slaves who needed liberation. If there was ever anybody to whom the term extreme liberals could be applied, it was Marcus and Rebecca Redhound. Born into the considerable wealth of Grand Earth families, they were happy to contribute financially as well as actively to the cause. Along with a small, equally dedicated cabal, they planned a raid against the Hive, which they were convinced would be the grand event that would finally demonstrate to the rest of the Commonwealth that the Foundation was wrong, not just in its politics, but in its science as well. After months of covert planning and preparation, 9 of these urban rich kid commandos broke into one of the Foundation's birthing wards in the Hive's capital, Fordsville. They managed to steal 7 new birthed babies and get them to the CST planetary station before the alarm was raised. 3 infants were traced immediately by the Intersolar Sirius Crimes Directorate and returned to their creche on Huxley's Haven. The publicity was everything the group could have wished for, though public sympathy didn't entirely swing their way. Something about stealing babies just cut people cold. 4 of the cabal were arrested when the babies were traced. After that, the Sirius Crimes Directorate mounted the largest manhunt the Commonwealth had ever seen to find the 4 missing babies, 1 male and 3 females. It took another 15 months of painstaking detective work by 10 chief investigators, aided by the SI, to locate the missing boy in a town on the then frontier planet of Ferrara. 5 months after that, 2 more of the girls were recovered on Edinburgh. The last child and remaining 2 cabal members proved more elusive. With the paranoia that the only truly committed can muster, Marcus and Rebecca had spent over 2 years fomenting elaborate preparations for the snatch, an activity they kept secret from the rest of their cabal. The first part of their cover was to have a child of their own, Koya, who would act as a sister to the Hive baby. She would set a normal behavioral example to the psychoneural profiled waif, and a young family with twins would be less likely to attract attention. It was a good plan. Marcus and Rebecca had bought a house on Marindra, out in a small agricultural town, where they established a market garden business. It was a pleasant place to live, with a good community spirit. The children fitted in well as they grew up. Paula's half-Filipino features were slightly incongruous, given her parents and twin Koya were all of prominent Eastern Mediterranean stock, but they explained it away as a genetic modification designed to bring out Rebecca's distant Asian ancestry, honoring her deep ethnic origin. By then, the case of the last missing Hive baby had long faded from public attention. As a child, Paula really wasn't too different from her sister. They played together, ran their parents ragged, loved the puppy Marcus bought them, had a fondness for swimming, and did well at school. It was as she moved into her teens that Paula was noticeably more restrained than Koya. She did as her parents asked, didn't argue with them, and steered clear of all the trouble that was to be found in their little rural community. Everyone commented on what a nice girl she was becoming, not like half of the teenagers in this town who were simply terrible and a sure sign of society's imminent collapse. She regarded boys with the same contempt and fascination as her peers. Started dating, suffered the heart-aching humiliation of being dumped, and promptly took it out on her next 2 boyfriends by chucking them. Found another boy she liked, and went steady for 5 months. In sports, she was competent rather than outstanding. Academically, she excelled at languages and history. As teachers remarked, she had superb recall and an obsession with tracing down the smallest facts connected to her subjects. Aptitude tests showed she would make a great psychologist. Looking at their contented, normal extra daughter on her 16th birthday, Marcus and Rebecca knew they had succeeded. They'd brought up a Hive child in a loving, natural environment and produced a perfectly happy, healthy human being. What could be done with one could be done to all. The Foundation's hold over its oppressed population could be broken. Their method of control was flawed. Decency and human dignity had triumphed in the end. 2 days later, on a splendid late summer afternoon, they took Paula out into the garden and told her of her true heritage. They even sheepishly showed her the old news media recordings of the snatch and subsequent manhunt. What the Foundation had never revealed was the nature of the psychoneural profiling given to the snatched babies. The others were all reasonably standard for Huxley's Haven. Public service workers, engineers, accountants, even an archivist. But Paula, as luck or fate would have it, was an exception even among her own kind. Crime on Huxley's Haven was extremely rare, naturally so given its citizens were all designed to be content in their jobs and lives. But not even the Foundation claimed to make life perfect. All human civilizations needed a police force. On Huxley's Haven, it was a source of national pride that there was 1 law enforcement officer for every 10,000 people.
Paula was destined to be one of them. 2 hours after their joyful confession, Marcus and Rebecca were in custody. It was Paula who turned them in. She had no choice. Knowing what was right and what was wrong was the core of her identity, her very soul. The last missing Hive child was the greatest media story to hit the Unisphere for a decade, making Paula an instant celebrity. Young, beautiful, and frighteningly incorruptible, she was everything a 16-year-old should never be. Thanks to Paula's relentless testimony, Marcus and Rebecca were sentenced to 32 years life suspension each, losing double the time over which their crime was perpetrated. It was the kind of punishment normally reserved for murderers. Unisphere coverage of the trial allowed a quarter of the human race to watch in silent fascination as Koya broke down and screamed hysterically at the judge before begging her step-twin to withdraw the sentencing application. Paula's only answer, a silent, pitying glance at the sobbing girl, made that whole quarter of the human race shiver. After the trial, Paula went back to Huxley's Haven, the home she'd never known, to discover her real name and suffer embarrassing introductions to the other stolen children with whom she had nothing in common. She belonged there even less than on Merindra. A modern Commonwealth education put her completely outside the norm as far as Huxley's Haven was concerned. They didn't have advanced technology on the Hive. The new conformist society was structured so that people did all the work, not machines. With her exposure to domestic bots and the ultimate data access of the Unisphere, Paula considered such rejection to be stupid and provincial. It was the one success Marcus and Rebecca had with shaping her thoughts, though by then their bodies were beyond knowing, safely comatose in the Justice Directorate's hibernation wombs. Away from the public eye, Paula left Huxley's Haven for Earth, where she enrolled at the Intersolar Serious Crimes Directorate. At the time, she had no idea how high up the political food chain her application was bounced before it was finally approved. But approved it was, and inevitably she became the best operative they ever had, despite the one notorious case of 2243 that she still hadn't solved. Morton lived in the penthouse of a 50-story skyscraper standing behind Dark Lake City's Labuk Marina, not at all far, in fact, from Carolyn Turner's last lunch with Tara. Paula noted the coincidence as the car drove them along the waterfront. They parked in the skyscraper's underground garage and took the express lift up to the top floor. Morton was waiting for them in the vestibule as the doors opened. 3 years out of rejuvenation, he was a tall, handsome young man whose thick chestnut hair was tied back in a long ponytail. Dressed in a fashionably cut amber and peacock blue tropical shirt and expensive hand-tailored linen slacks, he looked good and obviously knew it. His youthful face put on a broad, courteous smile as he shook their hands in welcome. "Good of you to see us," Paula said. It was early evening local time, which was only a few hours ahead of Paris time. "Least I could do." Morton ushered them inside through elaborate double doors. His penthouse had a floor area larger than the plantation house where his ex-wife now lived. They walked into a massive split-level living room with a window wall. It was 6:30, and the copper-red sun had already fallen level with the top of the skyscraper, shining its rich, hazy light directly into the penthouse. Opulent furnishings and expensive artwork gleamed in glorious twilight hues as they soaked up the illumination. There was a large roof garden on the other side of the wide glass doors, half of which was taken up with a swimming pool. Beyond the stainless steel railings ringing the patio area was a tremendous view out across the city and lake. The three of them settled in the lavish conversation area in front of the glass wall. Morton ordered it to raise its opacity, banishing most of the glare. That was when Paula saw someone in the pool, a young girl, swimming lengths with powerful, easy strokes. She told her e-butler to bring up Morton's file. There was no current registered marriage, but local media gossip files had linked him to a string of girls since he came out of rejuvenation. His current lover was Melanie Rescari, a First Life 19-year-old and member of the Oak Tier National Diving Squad. Melanie's parents were on record as strongly objecting to the liaison. In reaction, Melanie had simply moved out of the family home and into Morton's penthouse. "Something to drink?" Morton asked. The butler appeared at his side. dressed in antique-style black clothes. Paula stared at him, mildly surprised. A real-life human servant, not a bot.
No, thank you, she said.
Hosha shook his head. I'll have my sparkling gin, thank you, Morton said. It is after office hours, after all.
Yes, sir.
The butler gave a discreet bow and walked over to the mirrored drinks cabinet. I understand it was you who alerted the police about this situation, Paula said.
That's right.
Morton leaned back casually into the leather cushioning. I thought it was kind of strange that Kotal had to be relived as well as Tara. To me it implied that they died at the same time, which is kind of suspicious, especially as nobody ever found out how Tara died. I'm surprised nobody else made the connection, actually. His polite smile focused on Hosha.
Different insurance companies, different clinics, Hosha said defensively. I'm sure YOB would have raised the question with my division eventually when he asked after Ms. Shahif.
Of course. So you recognized the name? Paula asked.
Yes. God knows why I didn't edit the little shit out of my memories during the last two rejuvenations.
Subconscious, I guess. You learn from your experiences. A smart man doesn't dump them.
So was it a painful divorce from Tara?
Her leaving me was a shock. I simply didn't see that coming. I mean, with hindsight, I was heavily involved with our company, and we'd been together for a while. I suppose it was inevitable. But to walk out like that, without any warning, that wasn't Tara. Not the Tara I thought I knew, anyway. But I got over it the same way a lot of guys do. Screwed every piece of skirt in sight and threw myself into my work. After that, the actual divorce was completely irrelevant. Just a signature certificate loaded on a file.
And there was no clue she was going to leave you.
Hell no. I was worried about her when I got back from my conference. I mean, she hadn't answered my calls for 2 days. But I figured at the time she was pissed with me for spending the time away from home. Then when I got back, she'd stripped the apartment. Everything she owned was gone.
Pretty big fucking clue, huh?
The butler returned with the sparkling gin in a crystal glass and put it on the side table next to Morton.
Will that be all, sir?
For now. Morton waved him away.
Was there any message?
Paula asked.
Not a damn thing. The first and only time I heard from her was when the divorce file arrived 2 weeks later.
That was handled by a legal firm. So you never actually had any contact with Tara at all?
No. Not after she left.
How did you know Wyobi Kotal's name?
It was in the divorce file.
Tara put it in.
Yes. He was the irreconcilable difference.
I'd like a copy, please.
Sure.
He instructed his e-butler to release a copy of the file to Paula.
I have to ask, did you benefit from the divorce?
Morton laughed with genuine amusement.
Sure did. I got rid of her.
He took a drink of his sparkling gin, still grinning.
That's not quite what I meant.
Yes, yes, I know. He locked his hands together behind his head and gazed up at the ceiling.
Let's see. There wasn't much to it.
We both came out of it financially secure. That was part of the pre-marriage contract. Everything to be split 50-50. It was fair enough. Tara was richer than me back then. She put up a higher percentage of initial capital for the company. That was no secret. But I was the one who managed it, who made it work. When we divorced, our shares were divided up strictly according to the contract. We both got half.
How much more money did she put in?
It was a 65-35 split. That percentage isn't something I'd kill for.
I'm sure.
So who kept the company?
I'm still running it, after a fashion. Aqua State's one of our subsidiaries now.
Paula consulted his file.
I see. You're the chairman of Gansu Construction now.
That's right. 6 months after we went public, Gansu made an offer for Aqua State. I negotiated a good 2-for-1 exchange rate on my shares, a seat on the Gansu board, and a decent options deal on more stock. 40 years of hard work later, and here I am. We're the biggest civil engineering outfit on this whole planet. You name it, we can build it for you. Plenty of off-planet divisions as well, and more opening every year. One day we'll rival the multi-stellars.
According to my records,
The company you and Tara owned, Aquastate, didn't go public until 3 years after the divorce.
Now, Tara agreed, or rather, her divorce lawyers did, that we'd both get a better deal by waiting, letting the moisture extraction business grow until we could get the maximum price from the flotation. When Aquastate finally went public, her shares were registered with a bank on Tampico. Then they were converted to Gansu stock when I sold out. I shouldn't really be telling you this, but since she got relifed, most of them have been sold. She's using up money at a hell of a rate, supporting that idiot aristocrat husband and his plantation.
Thank you, but I don't think that's relevant to our inquiry. I'm more interested in what happened to her shares for the 17 years prior to her relife. Did they just sit in the Tampico Bank?
As far as I know, yes. I only know they're being sold now because as chairman I can see the ownership registry. She's disposing of them at quite a rate. A couple of million Oak-tier dollars a year.
Paula turned to Hosha. We need to check with the Tampico Bank to find out what happened to those 17 years' worth of dividend payments.
Certainly.
Melanie Rescorai climbed out of the pool and started toweling herself down with the pink wash sky as a backdrop. She was very attractive, Paula conceded. Morton was staring at her with a greedy expression.
What about enemies? Paula asked. Did Tara have any?
No. Morton was still looking at his trophy girlfriend. That is, I doubt it. I don't actually remember. I got rid of the majority of those memories. Just kept the essentials from those days, you know?
And you? Did you have enemies back then?
I wouldn't go that far. I had business rivals, certainly. And I've got a damn sight more of them now. But no deal would be worth killing over. Not in those days.
Only those days?
Or these, he said with a grin.
Did you meet up with Tara again? After the relive?
Yes. The insurance investigators and the police both had a load of questions for me. All of them the same as yours. I went to see her after she came out of the clinic for old time's sake. To make sure she was okay, and on hold grudges, and we'd had 13 good years together. We still meet up, occasionally, parties, social events, that kind of thing, though that's getting less and less now she's got her husband. I haven't actually seen her since my last rejuvenation.
You and Tara didn't have any children, did you?
Morton's attention switched back to the living room.
No.
Why not?
As you said, you were together for 13 years.
We decided we didn't want them. It was even written into our pre-marriage contract. Both of us were busy people. The lifestyle we had then didn't have any space for that kind of family commitment.
Okay, one last question. Probably irrelevant, considering you've had 2 rejuvenations since, but do you remember any odd incidents prior to her disappearance?
Sorry, no. Not a thing. If there were any, they're memories that I left behind a long time ago.
I thought that might be the case. Well, thank you again for seeing us.
Morton stood up and showed the chief investigator out. As they walked through to the vestibule, he let his eyes slip down to her rump. Her business skirt was clinging in an enjoyable way, showing off her hips. Even though he'd accessed her court cases several times through the Unisphere, her physical appearance post-rejuvenation was a pleasurable surprise. He wondered if she'd be going to a silent world tonight. If so, it was one he'd like to be visiting. When they'd gone, he went back out onto the roof garden. Melanie smiled at him with the simple happiness of the totally devoted.
So, was she murdered? The girl asked.
They don't know.
She twined her arms around his neck, pressing her still damp body against him.
Why do you care? It was centuries and centuries ago.
40 years, and I'd care very much if it happened to you.
Her lips came together in a hurt pout.
Don't say that.
The point is, time doesn't lessen a crime, especially not today.
Okay.
She shrugged and smiled at him again.
I won't run away from you like she did. Not ever.
I'm glad to hear it.
He bent forward slightly and started kissing her, an action that she responded to with her usual eagerness. Her youthful insecurity had been so easy to exploit,
especially for someone with his years of life experience. She'd never known anyone as urbane and self-confident, nor as rich. The only people she'd ever dated were nice first-life boys. By herself, she wasn't brave enough to break out from her middle-class conformity. But with his coaxing and support, she soon began to nibble at the forbidden fruits. The publicity of their affair, the arguments with her parents, it all played in his favor. Like all first-lifers, she was desperate to be shown everything life could offer, and as if by a miracle, he'd appeared in her life to fill the role of both guide and paymaster. Suddenly, after all the years of discipline and restrictions she'd endured to reach national level in her sport, nothing was outlawed to her. Her response to the liberation was a very predictable overindulgence. Melanie wasn't quite the most beautiful girl he'd ever bedded. Her chin was slightly too long, her nose too blunt, to be awarded that title. But with that lanky, broad-shouldered body of hers, trained to the peak of gymnastic fitness, she was certainly one of the most physically satisfying. Although truly it was her age that excited him in a way he'd never reached with any of his silent world encounters. Even in this liberally inclined society, a rejuve seducing a first-lifer was regarded as being over the edge of civilized behavior, which simply added intensity to the experience. He could afford to ignore the disapproval of others. This was what he was now, one of the rich and powerful, rising above the norm, the mundane. He lived his personal and professional lives in the same way. If there was something he wanted in either of them, he got it. Empire building became him, allowing him to thrive. Compared to his first mediocre century, he was truly alive now. "Go in and get changed," he told her eventually. His e-butler summoned the dresser and the beautician to help get the girl ready. "Risal is expecting us on the boat in an hour. I don't want to be too late. There are people coming that I need to meet tonight."
"It's not all business, is it?" Melanie asked.
"Of course not. There'll be fun people there as well. People your own age, and people older than me. Now please, we need to get moving."
"Yes, Morty."
Melanie caught sight of the two women waiting for her, and turned back to him.
"What would you like me to wear?"
"Always something that shows you off." His virtual vision was displaying recent clothing purchases the dresser had made. "That gold and white thing you were fitted for on Wednesday, that's small enough." She nodded eagerly.
"Okay."
Then she hugged him again, the kind of tight, reassurance-seeking embrace a child would give a parent.
"I love you, Morty. Really, I do. You know that, don't you?"
Her eyes searched his face, hunting for any sign of confirmation.
"I know."
His older, earlier self would probably have experienced a twinge of guilt at that adulation. It was never going to last. He knew that, even though she would never be able to see it. In another year or so, some other stray beauty would catch his eye, and the sweet heat of the chase would begin again. Melanie would be gone in a flood of tears.
But
until then. He gave her bum a quick, gentle slap, hurrying her back into the penthouse. She squealed in mock outrage before scampering in through the wide doors. The two women followed her in. His e-butler brought up a list of items that he hadn't finished working on during the day. He surveyed them all, taking his time to add comments, demand more information, or approve them for action. It was always the way. No matter how complex the management smartware a company employed, executive decisions were inevitably made by a human. An RI could eliminate a whole strata of middle management, but it lacked the kind of creative ability that a true leader possessed. When he tidied up the office work, the butler brought him another sparkling gin. Morton leaned on the steel balcony rail to sip the drink, gazing out at the city below as the sun fell below the horizon. He could outline sections of it in his mind, entire districts that Gansu had built, where their government-licensed subsidiaries now provided utility and civic services. His innovation, that. There were other areas as well that drew his eye. Old plantations and orchards that now formed the outskirts, green parquetry flocking around the base of the mountains. Gansu's architects had drawn up plans for beautiful buildings that would fit snugly into those crumpled mini-valleys, expensive, exclusive communities providing for Oak Tier's increasingly affluent population. Already, the farmers were being tempted with financial offers and incentives. When he looked up to the darkening sky, the stars were starting to twinkle. If everything went to plan, his influence would soon stretch out to them, far exceeding the small subcontracts their off-planet offices currently achieved. He controlled Gansu's board now. The increased business and rising stock price he'd achieved for them over the last decade had given him near-regal status. There would be no timidity in his expansion plans. The opportunities that lay out there were truly staggering. Entire civil infrastructures to be built, the new Phase 3 junction worlds that would one day rival the Big 15. Now was the best time to live. He lowered his gaze again to scan the city rooftops. One old, medium-sized tower caught his attention. It was the apartment block he and Tara had lived in for most of their marriage. He'd never realized he could see it from his roof garden. There were no details from this distance. Twilight transformed it into a gray slab with parallel lines of light shining out through the windows. He took another sip of the cocktail as he stared at it. His memory couldn't even provide an image of the apartment's interior. When he'd gone in for rejuvenation 6 years after the divorce, he'd edited away everything but the basic information from his secure store. Now, that life was almost like a series of notes in a file, not real, not something he'd lived through. And yet, 20 years ago, when he'd heard of Tara's re-life procedure, something about it had nagged at him. It was out of character to go and see her, yet he had. The semi-neurotic woman in her new clone body wasn't anybody he recognized, certainly not the kind of woman he could form an attachment to. He put that down to shock and psychological trauma from the re-life. Then the news about Kotal had been filtered out of the Unisphere media streams by his e-butler, which had caught the connection to Tara. He'd stopped work in his office, an unheard-of event, and worried about how strange the coincidence was. His staff had made a few discreet inquiries. The results of that had been enough for him to call the police. Their subsequent report on the case had annoyed him with its vagueness and lack of conclusion. Rather than kick up a fuss himself, which would draw comment, he'd spoken to some of the senior members of the Shahif family. He hadn't quite expected someone as renowned as Chief Investigator Mayo herself to be assigned the case, but it was a pleasing development. If anyone could sort out what had actually happened, it would be her. His thoughts slipped to her compact body again, and the high possibility of her needing to visit Silent World. Morty? He turned around. The dresser and beautician had worked their usual magic. Melanie was standing silhouetted in the light from the living room, her auburn hair dried and straightened so it fell down her back, the tiny dress exposing vast amounts of toned young flesh. His disquiet over Tara and Kotal vanished at once, as he contemplated what new indecencies he would tutor her in later tonight. "Do I look all right?" she asked cautiously. "Perfect,"